Okay, so I think we're ready to start again. And we figured this time it'd be a little bit more informal and allow you guys to ask questions. Jameson Crabtree, who is the other editor-in-chief of Sonora Review, is going to be bringing around a microphone whenever you raise your hand with your questions. So without any further ado from me, I think you guys can probably, if you have a question. Oh, yeah, to really quickly reintroduce for anyone who's new to the panel, this is Bonnie Nadel from the Frederick Hill Bonnie Nadel Literary Agency, who represented Wallace for 23 years. It's Greg Carlisle, author of Elegant Complexity, A Study of Infinite Jest. Glenn Kenny, who is a former film critic for Premiere. What is the name of your blog?
I'll write a blog, too. It's Some Came Running at Typepad. It's somecamerunning.typepad.com.
And Glenn also edited a couple pieces, three pieces total, of David Foster Wallace's. And then Marshall Boswell, author of Understanding David Foster Wallace, Charles Bach, author of Beautiful Children, and Ken Kalfas at the far end, author of Thirst, and most recently Disorder Peculiar to the Country. So if anyone has a question, you can just raise your hand.
Or should we just start talking amongst ourselves and then you all can answer?
Well, the question that I had, I was thinking a little bit about voice, and I don't have a very articulate question about this necessarily. But if you, just throwing out another sort of amorphous question, and whoever wants to field it, what would you say about Wallace's concern for voice or the way in which he developed voice in his work?
Glenn talked about the erudition that you encounter when you read Wallace, and I think that's an important thing to tap into, because I think it's the source of the voice for me in a lot of ways. That emergence of Wallace's fiction in the mid-80s happens amid the flowering of critical theory and post-structuralism, and one of the things about Wallace's writerly identity is that he's very well versed in that material. He knows deconstruction. He knows Foucault. He's written about it. You can see it in the work. He's informed by it, but he was suspicious of it. And I think what he found in that sort of deconstructionist model is that it leaves texts alienated from the world. I think he understood how you get there, the idea of, in Derrida, of language being play. And when you have that, there's no place for the reader to do anything. The language, the play is the text, and the world has been deferred out of the text. And I think Wallace's intervention into that argument by way of Wittgenstein is important, because Wittgenstein's counterargument, which precedes Derrida, is to conceive of language not as words in a chain of signifiers, but as a game, as a language game played by players. And that meaning is a product of agreement on the set of rules. You can see that in Broom of the System, where character they call telephones, magazines, or something. They come up with all this other words for natural objects as an experiment in Wittgenstein. If everyone decides that this is called a cat, and I say I read a cat last night, we all know what that means. That's how you get the word. For Wallace, that's the intervention, because if language is really about a communal understanding, a communication of a community of users, then I think books can become directly communicative again in a way that I think postmodernism had let go of. The text becomes so involuted and self-reflexive that the reader is left standing outside that funhouse looking at this giant edifice that you're supposed to admire, but you don't feel anything for it. So that intimacy of that voice comes out of a philosophical grounding in language as a communication between two people. He's not there in these texts, but that language, that voice, is the voice of Wallace in your head. If you notice, at the end of Infinite Jest, this wraith appears to Gately while he's splayed out in the hospital, and it talks to Gately in Gately's own voice. And if you're paying attention, that wraith, that ghost at the end of that book, is alternately Jim Incandenza's ghost, but also it's Wallace. At one point, the wraith will push his glasses up. There's little details that suggest that's Wallace in Gately's head, but it's Wallace in your head when you're reading Wallace. And that intimacy, I think, is something he achieves deliberately through a kind of adaptation of a Wittgensteinian model of communication. I don't want that to sound too erudite, but I think that's important.
And in
that respect, what you're talking about with the Wraith in Infinite Jest, he kind of out Nabokov's Nabokov, who used a similar device at the end of Ben Sinister, where Nabokov, the author, reveals himself to the lead character, who goes mad as a result, but is therefore sort of put out of his misery in a way. And I think what Dave does actually, it's almost sacrilegious to say this, is on a philosophical level more sophisticated than what Nabokov did. It's he raises the game just a little bit. Just as with talking about what happens in the eschaton thing, it's not three-dimensional chess. It's about 20-dimensional chess that's going on, you know? And one thing, you know, it was interesting when Dave's book Everything and More came out, his study of infinity, and I think it's one of his most misunderstood books, because all the I'm not going to say the F word. No, but you know, but the book review editors all gave it to like math experts who said, well, he's wrong here, which misses almost the entire point of what he's doing in the book in relating math problems and the Fermat's theorem to a philosophical perspective, a Wittgensteinian philosophical perspective. It's not strictly a math book, and you know, it was decided, I guess, you know, it wasn't really a conspiracy, but it was almost like, oh, Dave Foster Wallace is writing a math book. Well, we'll show him. And everybody just did not get it. I mean, beyond the point of not getting it just technically, but not getting it, you know?
There's a reason they don't get it, because that book is a hard book. That is not a, because you can't read it. Look, that's his wife. And he says in the first 10-20 pages, you only need high school math. But like he doesn't say that the high school is the fucking, you know, yeah, the MIT, the children of the brains of the, you know, whatever. Like, it's crazy. So that's not fair. You know, like, oh, blah, 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 it was misunderstood. Well, you know, who can't get through it? Whatever it is, it's unreadable. You know?
No, it's not.
Well, you're smarter than I am, so good for you. I would say this, just to go somewhere else with voice, is, I think his big influence with a lot, his magazine work. People read his magazine work, and people love his magazine work, and it's deservedly so. It's just the best candy ever, and it's also nourishing. His fiction, he pulled no punches at anything, and he did it. I think he was in a contest with himself and to entertain himself and to move himself, and he raised the bar. And it's much harder for people to follow along. And I think the last 10 years, especially with the rise of one particular critic, his fiction, a lot of his fiction, and because he hadn't published another novel, and he concentrated on the short fiction, his fictional reputation, it didn't stay where it was. I think everyone knows he's a genius, and everyone looked for it. Each book was an event. But there's readers I know who are in tributes to David Foster Wallace and who were very vocal about what the loss was, who didn't read his short fiction of the last book. And I want to throw that out there, because I think that's part of the legacy, is that you have someone who's uncompromising at the work that meant the most to him. And I think he wanted to be read. He very much wanted to be read. And but he will be read now, because he's going to be a cult legend forever. But I don't think that it was the same the last 5 years. That's just my own.
One
particular critic who spent years and years in every essay he wrote taking a shot at David Foster Wallace.
You know, I loved him in Casino.
I mention his name, my head explodes.
He was great in Cop. That was fantastic work. Oh.
Don't confuse them.
I kid. Well, you know, it's funny because when I read Brief Interviews with Hideous Men for the first time, and this gets into, you know, some of the stuff that's part of the tragedy where we're here. When I read Brief Interviews for the first time, I was actually worried about him because I was like, whoa, because it was such an immersion into this place of dark anxiety. And then he came to New York to read from it, and he read what I thought were some of the, was one of the most harrowing portions of the book, the part about the amputee who called, not the amputee, the thalidomide guy who calls his shriveled up arm the asset, then segueing into the guy who cleans bathrooms in this long, almost unbearable treatment of the olfactory sensations of doing this. And he read it in such a way that all of a sudden you realize this was some of the funniest stuff in the book. And then I thought, oh, okay. It's fine. But that ability to be both absolutely hellishly harrowing and hysterically funny at the same exact time, not like an alternating thing, not like it's like this is dark and now I'm going to give you a joke and lighten it with humor. The humor was just as dark, but the humor was still so funny. So laugh out loud funny. And you know, he had this shyness to him, and so was sometimes on, you know, this low comfort level with crowds. But by the same token, you know, anybody who saw him read knew that when he got in the zone and he knew exactly what he was doing in terms of reading, he was the best reader of his own work because he put that forward in such a way. And people are sitting, like, rolling in the aisles, and he's not even breaking a smile, but he knows how he's getting across. So, you know.
Well, that was the thing about Boom the System also when it came out. It had all these, it was a clear announcement of that he was the new kid on the block, but it was also an announcement what neighborhood he wanted to live in. And it was a neighborhood, as I say, is in disrepute. I mean, there was the Pynchon, there was the Barth, there was the Gaddis. There's even a character there in that novel from Shillington, Pennsylvania. And the only reason anyone knows about Shillington, Pennsylvania is John Updike's from there. But these weren't clumsy attempts not to... This wasn't a failure to hide his influence. They were announcements of his influence. But what was different about his use of those modes was how fun the book was. The book was a blast. And one of the things that you read through all of his criticism is a fascination with entertainment. Fun is one of his themes. And I think he began to think about, this is maybe his function as a Gen X writer, he began to think about the idea of text as entertainment. He felt like it was a job of books to give pleasure again in the way that TV does. I don't think that's a crass thing to say, but he's very, if you chart this, and I'll pass the microphone on, but if you chart, I can show you this in the book, Understanding David Foster Wallace out in paperback coming out, but there's three different formulations of the same idea. It's in Unimus Plurum, it's in West Where the Course of Empire Takes Its Way, and he says it again, Hal says it somewhere in the deep grottos of Infinite Jest. The formulation is that cynicism and naivete are not mutually exclusive. This was his intervention more than anything else. Cynicism, I consider the kind of self-consciousness, the self-awareness, the understanding of conventions and hollowness of various kinds of fictional forms, which his book exemplifies. But he's trying to do that while also reintroducing a kind of naivete and openness to what he calls single entendre and principles. Honor, goodness, empathy, these things that he wants to remove the quotation marks around and reaffirm. The difficulty of the fiction also often is that he doesn't want to do it directly. The affirmation happens sort of off the page. And I think that's what people respond to, that sense that something ethical is going on in these texts. But it's something that the text produce in the reader. And, I mean, I can talk for hours about how they do that, but they do that in a way that I think his imitators have been trying to get, and it's that tone of cynicism and naivete that Wallace invents and that I think his followers have tried with varying degrees of success to manage.
I was going to say, when both Adam Gopnik and A.O. Scott have separately said that when they read Infinite Jest, you know, they heard the voice inside their own head, and I've always thought, yeah, you in your dreams, like they're flattering themselves by thinking that that's the voice inside their own head. But for 10 years, there have been writers from, like, Tom Bissell's not here, Heidi Julewicz isn't here, Colson Whitehead. You can read parts of these people's books and know what books of Dave's they were reading. And I'm not saying that to rip on them. You could do that with parts of the chapter 2.1 of Beautiful Children. You could see it's just there that that he set the pace for a lot of us. And at the same time, like, both N plus one and McSweeney's are separate outgrowths of the work of David Foster Wallace.
Well, Dave Eggers.
Dave Eggers, who you know, had not heard of him until he asked him to submit something. And then his whole, you know, extreme, whatever, heartbreaking work of a staggering genius. Yeah. You know, that's Wallace light. And I'm not saying anything shocking or revelatory here. I don't think for a lot of us. And the same thing with Kunkel, Ben Kunkel, and the little one Gessen. That they're both in different directions, taking different parts of his work, and one deals with a certain kind of sincerity that you're talking about, and the other one deals with critical faculty and being doubting and casting a certain kind of eye. So you have this shadow that the man's cast. I think.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the A.O. Scott. You mentioned the A.O. Scott piece. I happened to read that last night on the plane, and. It's the New York, one of the New York Review of Books,
right.
And I suspect when people say that, the way I take it, yeah, is that you read a really great writer with a great voice, and it becomes part of your brain. Yeah. That you start thinking. I mean, this is definitely a feeling I get reading Wallace, that for the next couple of days I'm going to think like him,
right.
You know, and I'm going to have that kind of. The language gives you all. Unfortunately, it doesn't last very long, but you have that acuity, and you develop. And a great writer will do that. And I didn't read the who was the other critic? Adam Gopnik. Well, I didn't read. I don't know what he meant, but I suspect that I've had that feeling too. And it's not that I can write like that, but I do feel I've been sort of given the gift of this acuity for a couple of days at least.
Right. It is true that for David, writing the nonfiction was way easier than writing fiction. And the fiction came hard. And the nonfiction, you know, for him, it was sort of like Look Ma, No Hands, like any kid on a bicycle. And those were the easiest things to sell. And there was a point where, I mean, David started doing magazine work for money, the way most writers do. Because it was a long time between books, and he was working on Infinite Jest, and the advance for Infinite Jest was not large and certainly small increments, and so it was a matter of, like, how can I make $5,000? And Glenn will tell you that paying $5,000 for David Wallace, you're essentially paying a penny a word at a certain point. I mean, because I was like, could you not make it 15,000 words that they have to cut down?
And I really knew how to make it work against him.
Right, and I mean, so he'd be like, you're going to be mad at me again, aren't you? And I was just like, why did you, you know? But it's
and
true.
The time, I don't mean to interrupt, but just to demonstrate that, we were in Las Vegas January 8th, he left. The Big Red Sun manuscript showed up at my office around Valentine's Day.
Right. So it was pretty fast. In what Charles was saying about sort of the fiction versus the nonfiction, I mean, as one of the two people who has read this unfinished novel, it's about boredom. I mean, who writes a book about IRS agents and boredom and how bored you can get looking at numbers? I mean, it's like taking the hardest thing you can possibly ever do and then doing it. And, you know,
And it's amazing. I mean, it sounds, you know, that's as trite as it sounds, but it really is an amazing book. And in its way. And I mean, he also, he took tax courses, I mean, for like 3 years so that he could learn all the tax things. And I have like tax books that you're like, who has, you know, sent away for tax books so that you can learn all about taxes in order to write a book about IRS agents and taxes. And it's funny and it's smart and it's heartbreaking and it's all those things. What? Parts of it are perfect. I mean, it's, the first parts are incredibly clean. I mean, the parts, there were two sections that were in The New Yorker, one small section that was in Harper's, and there, which are just a few of the characters who are in this book. I mean, because it's a whole group of IRS agents who live in the Midwest. Since, for David, I mean, every writer has sort of their place, which is their place that they write about. I mean, he was a Midwest boy, like through and through, that no matter where he lived, whether it was Tucson or Boston, the Midwest is what had the resonance for him, and he kept going back to it. So, you know, it's the Midwest in the mid-80s, which wasn't pretty for anybody. I mean, you know. I mean, it's driving Pintos. Do you remember Pintos, any of you? Yeah, yeah. Not a good car.
And when he wanted to write about something, he wanted to know everything about it. So when he did the AVN piece, this was brilliant, the AVN, the Adult Video News Awards, they nominate literally hundreds of films every year.
And he watched most of them.
And they nominate in different categories, best facial, best oral sex scene, best threesome, best groove sex. And he had this idea, he wanted to see everything that was nominated, and then he figured out that it was mathematically impossible for one person to watch everything that was nominated. So we figured we would go with just a cross-section of nominees. The thing is, he was living in Normal at the time. He was living in a town called Normal.
Yeah. Right. And Illinois.
Sorry, I always get those two.
You know, right. Yeah.
And not a lot of access to porn. So our thing would be at premiere, me and a couple of my buddies who were fact checkers there. Lunch breaks, random lunch breaks. We'd go. This was, you know, around the time where 8th Avenue was still, you know, a great place to buy porno. And we'd go on our Q for P, Quest for Porn, and we'd go and stock up on a bunch of videotapes, Stephanie Swift, Gangbang Angel, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's the one where she gets spit in the face 13 times by 13 guys. Jasmine St. Clair. And we'd send them to Dave. He would watch and take notes. Then he'd send them back to the office. Because he didn't want, having watched them and taken notes, he did not want them in his house anymore. And we ended up getting so many videotapes, porn videotapes. I left my office in a fairly quick manner when I left Premiere.com, and I can only imagine the riches that some of the facilities guys yielded in terms of what is now vintage pornography. But yeah, he wanted to know everything. And if he could have watched all those nominees, he would have. Absolutely. Ugh. Yeah, we have a question. Finally. Yay.
I had a question for the academics. Well, it's a rare thing, right, that writing about someone, like an academic work about someone who's still living. Which he was at the time, and I was just wondering about whether or not, like, whether you gleaned any sort of reaction to that work, or
gleaned. Do you mean,
like, whether or not directly or indirectly you heard anything about sort of Wallace's reaction to your work, or
never
reaction
did.
Of like his, you know, acolytes or whatever.
Never did. I the one story I came prepared to tell was I never met David Foster Wallace, but when I was writing the book, I'd reached a point where I had a load of unanswered questions, including questions about his biography, but also questions about details in Infinite Jest. What happens to Hal at the end? What happens to Madame Psychosis? I mean, just questions that just seemed impossible to resolve, and I thought I'd ask him. So I sent a letter to him saying, I'm Marshall Boswell. I'm writing this book. I have some questions. Would you be willing to answer them? Months passed without any response because he was moving to Pomona. The letter finally came back. What he did was he sent my letter back to me with his answers in red felt tip footnotes on the letter, which, when my house burns down, I'm grabbing my kids in that letter. I'm Marshall Boswell. There's a one. You flip it over, and he writes hi and a smiley face. And you flip it back. Just a cherished thing. And so I wrote him a list of these questions, and he responded. he responded. He said, "I could never tell anyone that he did this because he didn't want people bothering him. That was, but I think I can tell you now." And he wrote back 8 pages of single space legal pad handwritten responses, and they're just fascinating. He didn't answer a lot of the questions I asked. It was very slippery, but some of them he did. And then I sent him the book when it was over, and waited and waited and waited, and I never heard back from him, which is just as well.
I knew from posts on the internet that when a student at Pomona would bring it up, he would get angry, and so I never even thought. I just assumed it would never be on his radar, a book about Infinite Jest, because he didn't like to talk about that work. So I never even thought to try to do. Just from what I'd said, I didn't want to make him angry. So that was.
Why did he get angry? Did you ever?
Well, you probably more. I assume it. Well, any other. I know some writers that don't like to talk about that. You know, you talk about an academic talking to a writer is like, don't try to piece out my work. It's like that's the academic's job to comment on it. And it's two different things.
I think in that particular context,
yeah. I think it actually is.
And he also
was
didn't
really
want
shy.
To be about him.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Right. I mean, he was a really shy person, and he's not somebody who lived in the middle of New York or L.A. or any big city. He lived, you know, in Normal, Illinois, and Pomona and Claremont, California. These are not the red hot center of anything, though they're very nice places. Actually, I'm not sure Normal's a nice place, but I think it actually has to do with his classes were really for his students, and I think he didn't want to appear to be a star or a celebrity or be like the star writer who came in. So I don't actually think it was, oh, I'm not going to comment to an academic. He's the child of academics. And his parents are both academics. I don't think it was that. I think it really was like, read the book, figure it out for yourselves, for your students. So I don't think it was meant as anything more than that.
Two other things. In West, the course of Empire Takes Its Way, the character Mark Nectar, who was David Foster Wallace, I think we're supposed to understand that, is anxious in that novella, about inheriting the language, is inheriting Dr. Ambrose's scepter as an academic writer, and he's worried about it. Because John Barth is the Ambrose figure in that story, and Barth is a dissertationist's dream. They're made for academics, and I think he was anxious about that. But I also think it's like the scene in Annie Hall when the guy's going on about Marshall McLuhan, and Marshall McLuhan walks up and says, "You have no idea what you're talking about." And the guy says, "Who are you? I'm Marshall McLuhan." And the critic still doesn't get it. He still thinks he knows what he's talking about.
No, and Dave's shyness was genuine. And you know, when I was at Premiere, I obviously, you know, met and dealt with a lot of people who are celebrities and who relish being celebrities. And there's some of them who will put on this air of, well, it's all well and good, but, you know, I'm not really such a big deal. But, no, Dave, it's strange because there were these two things that coexisted in his mind, this sort of negative capability, where he knew, there was a certain level he knew he was the shit. But on a personal kind of level of interacting with people, he never wanted to give anybody the impression that he was better than them or that he felt he was better than them. As I write in, I think, the first 3 conversations we had, he called me Mr. Kenny. I actually had to talk him out of doing that, and he wasn't doing it out of affectation or anything other than having what he thought were good manners. And for him, manners were absolutely inextricable from a much larger moral and ethical perspective that he tried very, very hard all through his life to maintain because it was the right thing to do.
I'm just going to... However shy he may have been, there was also a part of him that you don't write like that and be a complete, utter wallflower. It's just impossible. You can't. I mean, socially and however his interactions with people, there was also something there. And this is in E Pluribus Unum about the U.S. American fiction writer. And I think it's in another interview he did where he talks about that you're divided because part of you wants to sit in the library and write your fiction. And then another part of you wants to dance on top of the table and say, look at me, look at me. The stylistic virtuosity of that early work that, you know, and what it coalesces into, he knew it. I mean, he knew what he had, but he also wanted other people to know what he had. And I don't think that's the same thing as being a Hollywood star with I'm not such a, you know, false humility. I think you were talking about it, something separate. But maybe part of it is a reaction to, you know, the stripped down Carver stuff, and part of it also is that you have this bursting mind that's processing everything and that's creating everything and that's in love with language and it's in love with forms, you know. And I think that's pretty cool. I think our culture is the better for having those people and that ambition and that desire to take it all on. So,
my question goes a little bit off of what's been talked about already, but the trend in his recent work away from what the persona of David Foster Wallace became with earlier work, as in the writing, seemed to have changed a little bit with what was in Oblivion, and certainly with the two excerpts, that as much as we saw the sincerity of the things before, it felt a little more apparent and a little more on the page, at least in Good People, and things in Oblivion. So I sort of talk about this, and you mentioned James Wood, or the man who will go unnamed. And Wood afterwards wrote a thing that he thought the place Wallace was going was interesting. That where he thought
in 2007, James Wood, after his first novel came out, or maybe a little earlier than that, and he got creamed, and he finally learned what it was to have someone tear you apart. James Wood underwent a sea change as a reviewer, and I think feels a certain level of remorse for some of the things he's written, and I think everything he's done, and since then he goes out of his way to bend over backwards for all kinds of different books, some of which may or may not deserve bending over backwards for.
Although his pseudo reconsideration certainly falls into the venerated Thanks of Pamphlet.
Yeah.
What I sort of mean to say is just that what I think he's pointing at is, I feel, close to accurate with regards to Wallace's writing changing.
Well,
so then I sort of want to know what people's opinion, that would be mostly like from Oblivion since, well, or what we've seen since then.
The title story of Oblivion is narrated, it seems to be narrated by the, I want to make sure, by one character, and it's actually narrated by the partner who is dreaming in the mind of another character. The formal tricks are deeper and they're more sophisticated and they're not as flashy, but the structure of that is quite something.
I guess with regards to his question, I thought that the philosophic math underpinning Good Old Neon, which was the first thing I read of his, just to begin with, you have the holy shit, like the guy, for me personally at least, it's like he's been reading my psychic man. Like that sense that it's almost, at some point of intelligence, it's almost physically impossible to have just an original moment. Like everything has to be kind of sifted out as to how it's going to be perceived and all of that. But then below that, like the conversation with the psychologist, where he's like, well, if you know that you're a fraud, how can you actually be a fraud? And the way in which, I don't know, but if y'all could speak to that, like, it's like his intelligence intensified. I read Infinite Jest after that and found it, unbelievably, but there was like this depth and subtlety to the stuff that was in Oblivion, where all of his work is masterwork, but it was really interesting to watch how he.
I've thought since I read Oblivion, something is going on here that it's going to take us a while to figure out. You read it, and it's like, wow, how do you explain this? Part of what I thought is each of these stories seem to have some kind of nested, you were just talking about one, and it happens, there's some kind of nested thing. There's that. You also have the sense of you're talking about the that compassion or humanity is on the page a little more, and I think I'm trying, inspired by that, I started thinking like you were again after that DT Maxx article came out, like what is this thing that's going on? And I'm trying to formulate a theory. I don't know if it's right. We'll find out as I keep thinking about it. Like Infinite Jest showed us like the American problem, and there's a picture of it, and we can identify with it. Oblivion, because it's short stories, takes a sharper look at that and tries to get underneath why we are that way. And according to what the people that read or the DT Maxx article said about the Pale King, it's almost like that's going to try to help us get through. Now I'm not just going to report about it or see what's underneath it. We're going to try to get through it with Pale King. And it seems like although when I read Infinite Jest, I'm like, I think everybody's a tennis player and an addict and a spy. And it's like everybody's like that. But apparently it seemed I'm guessing he thought it was still too wild. And we're going to get these problems these people are experiencing are not just for tennis players at a high school or people in a halfway house. I need to write about the people in Oblivion, and it gets a little closer to home. And now I need to write about these tax collectors, so your tax IRS people, so that this really is me and you. I thought that reading him in a jest.
I see this the natural progression, too, of what he was doing. I mean, I think you can make the argument, I do, again, in understanding David Foster. But it's a formulation I came up with, and I'm sticking with it. The early fiction, what it does to metafiction is it performs a metafictional critique of metafiction. It's a double negative. The actual formulation of the cynicism and naivete is always couched as a negative. He says he's under the delusion that they are incompatible. And you have to think about that because it's so they are compatible, but he doesn't say they're compatible. He says it's a delusion to think they're incompatible. It's the same way if you take two mirrors and you point them at each other, then you have a space between it, which is the world. Now, and that's where his texts are trying to take us. That's why I think if you read Greg's book, the narratives always point out. They don't resolve. They head into infinity, in a way, outside that text. I think if you read Oblivion, it's the natural progression of that because it doubles the involution. You begin to see it in that story, Octet, which does this. The Octet is about a writer trying to write a story called Octet, you know. And it's three levels of self-awareness. And then you get to the... That's a brief interviews. And then you see it in the press person, which I think is almost like it's the orphan that belongs in Oblivion in a way, because it anticipates that mode of, you know, the soul is not a smithy. And I love your word nesting. I mean, if the early fiction casts a self-reflection on self-reflection in order to sort of break out of irony, then these other texts are even more sophisticated in the way that they perform a triple involution. The old neon guy is self-aware about the fact that he's self-aware that he's a fraud. And he can't get to the place where he can feel a genuine emotion because every genuine emotion is couched in the awareness that it's a genuine emotion and therefore it's false. And this is a problem with textuality itself, that as soon as you are writing it, you've taken it out of the world and you've made it into a self-conscious literary thing. And I think he was just pushing that beyond, I don't know how far he could have gone with it, but even in Oblivion, it seems to me it's three or four levels of involution that I think it's where he had to go, and I think it's where he was taking us. And I think you're right, it's going to be a while before we can unpack it.
Well, if you look at Solomon Silverfish, one of the first things he wrote here,
he's doing it there.
Oh.
Yeah.
No. I can. Yeah.
We can record this way, though.
Oh, well.
Thanks.
I'm not going to go on. I would say too much.
I was talking with a writer friend of his, one of his confidants, and who was saying that he was really trying to reinvent himself stylistically. And I think these are all, these fine gentlemen have all pointed that out, you know, have shown how that's happening. And, you know, there's some, I think there's a level of paralysis and fear that he's trying to work through. And it's something that he's not just identified maybe in the American condition, but also in how hard it is to write. That when I read the opening pages of in the New Yorker of the excerpt, that was, I felt like it was about how hard it is to sit there and do your work. And that's not all it's about, but and maybe that's a relate that relates to maybe that relates to how much I dislike some of the things I'm working on at the moment. But I like viscerally felt it, and like when I was talking about how brave of a writer he is or was, I just. It can't be overstated enough, and I think that that's one of the things that just separates him from everyone around him, is that he took on the mental challenges and the physical challenges of moral questions and questions of life that are just, I mean, we all have to do it, but like that are just the worst. They're just the hardest, and he was the best guy in the room, the smartest guy in the room, taking on the hardest fucking questions. When does that happen? You know, who can do that? Or you know,
something at some point.
I'm listening. Sorry.
No.
I was thinking it might be really interesting, Bonnie, to ask you, both as one of the two people who've read Pale King, and also the person who first found Broom of the System and then read Wallace's work all the way from 1985 or whatever when you first read it, you know, through. If you could speak a little bit to this idea of the way that he progressed, his stylistic reinvention, and sort of the maturation or deepening of his work.
I think what you're all saying is true. I mean, when David started, he was a virtuoso, and it really was, I can do it, anything, and look, I can talk in a woman's voice, and I can talk in a man's voice, and I can, you know, it is, I can do everything, and I'm going to show you how I can do it. And, but that's what a 23-year-old does. It's like, if you're that good at anything, whether it's skateboarding or painting or music or anything, you're going to say, I'm going to show you everything. And as he got older, and changed, as we all do, and got to middle age, the person he was at 46 is not the person he was at 23 when I first met him. Because, you know, over the years, life hits everybody with hard knocks, and he got married, and he moved to the West Coast and sort of had a different view of the world. And certainly, The Pale King and Oblivion, because Oblivion really is the precursor to it, is trying to go someplace else. And it's trying to get rid of the bells and whistles. And it was trying to reach people in a different way. And I think it does. Because he disliked himself wanting to do the bells and whistles more than any of you could ever possibly. And part of it is, in the nonfiction, it sort of became shtick. I mean, it's like anyone where, you know, you've got a comedian and you've got a great line and you just keep using it over and over again. And he didn't, you know, he was too good to actually sort of want to rest on his laurels and do that over and over again, which, of course, is why he stopped writing these essays, except for going to Wimbledon and writing about Federer, which to him was like, if I had said, would you like to see the face of God? And the New York Times will pay for you to go see the face of God. You know, I mean, he would have done it for free. He would have done it for anything and loved it. And, I mean, it was the thing that made him happiest of the essays towards the end, because he loved tennis. And he wrote about Federer in a way that I even, like, I was like, wow, I watch these tennis matches. I have no idea that this is what this guy is doing. And it's amazing. But he chose not to do nonfiction because he didn't want to rely on the shtick. And, you know, people would be like, why don't you go to the Amazon? Why don't you go here? Why don't you go to the Academy Awards? Why don't you go pretty much anywhere? And as someone who didn't have a passport till he was about 40 years old, he didn't want to go very much of anywhere. He could see everything, you know, in Normal, Illinois that he needed to see, or in Claremont. And I think it really was sort of looking for a bigger moral vision and sort of how we live in the world. It really was. That was what the last one's about.
That moral vision, I mean, Charles is saying that the questioning of fiction is so brave. I think one of the things that's consistent about it, the answers to Paul is simple. They're embarrassingly simple. He's worried about how simple they are. I think a great example of how this works is the AA sections in Infinite Jest. Because, you know, you have all these characters who have lived inside their heads, and they can't believe that what's going to save them is a bunch of cliches. Over and over again, these are cliches. I'm too sophisticated for cliches. And the entire elaborate structure of Infinite Jest, in a way, is designed to recover those cliches. And you can't just send them in there because they're Hallmark cards. It takes a lot of work to recover those simple ideas. And I think the fact that he's writing a novel about boredom, at the level of boredom, sitting still and affirming the moment you're in is a cliche. And it's absolutely important to do. And I think that's the brave attempt, I think, is to recover simple ideas like empathy, goodness, grace, honor. Honor is a word that keeps coming up in the West where the course of empire takes its way. Honor. And he knows they have quotation marks. They've been discredited since Hemingway, if you read Farewell to Arms. But they're still there as important. So,
McCain
is about that.
Something like duty, which
duty, right? Yeah. That's what the whole McCain piece is about. Trying to figure out if you peel it away, here's a guy who suffered. Can I affirm this at some level, or is he completely lost to the machinery of spin? And spin, of course, is a perfect example of what Wallace's fiction does. It spins.
I'd quickly point out that, like the George Saunders a couple of years ago, and it's in. The Brain Dead Megaphone did an essay where he goes to India and the Buddha boy, the boy who hasn't eaten or moved in 7 months, and how hard, you know, and early there's that question of how hard it is to just stay still. And, there's someone who they were, that I think Saunders is one of the writers that David particularly liked and thought was really good and funny, and vice versa. And I think, you know, and that there's just a lot of wonderful good things that got spread into this world through his work and through other really brilliant writers who have been able to take up the mantle and do good things. I discovered Ken's work because of Dave's blurb, and
Dave was very generous in his reading and with other writers. We all know that, and I actually visited him in Normal. I met him 15 years after he first started publishing me here. Here's an early review, and I was. His involvement as a reader in contemporary fiction was almost hard to even. He read everything, and he enjoyed so many different kinds of books that weren't anything like what he was writing. And he supported writers like that. And the whole I was very impressed with people at Normal. There the other writers there too. They all looked up to him for that.
A funny story about the Federer piece. It's short. We had an art director at Premiere. He won't mind me telling this. Dirk Barnett, who every now and then when the subject came up, he says, "Well, you know, I'm glad Wallace won't write for us anymore because as an art director, I will not staunch those damn footnotes." He got a job at Play, and the first issue has the Federer piece in it. He staunched the footnotes.
I wasn't actually raising my hand for a question. We have time maybe for a couple more questions if people have them. And if we have the microphone still circulating. Did you have one?
No. Good. I was just going to ask Rick McPhee's Levels of Pain.
The David Busher book?
No. John McPhee. Levels of the Game. It's about Clark Gravener and Arthur Ashe. It's a book-length description of one match.
Right.
Dave was very interested.
I've read McPhee's The Butcher.
Yeah, Bradley. All Bradley, of them.
I'm sorry.
All of McPhee. Just from the town's players' perspective.
Well, McPhee's another one for the minutia of every subject he writes about.
Every. Just incredible.
I have a question for Bonnie. You read all these things about how he's edited, or you know how big Infinite Jest was when it came, and this back and forth of pulling apart. And I just wanted to know what your perspective. I mean, what really happened, or what your perspective is on that, and were you involved in any of this, or mediating, or how you deal with something that obviously is brilliant, but maybe not publishable, or you know as.
Sure, of course. The book was sold to Little Brown and was supposed to be about, I think, 250 or 300,000 words, certainly not the 600,000 words it wound up being. And it came in at 1,600 pages. And I read all 1,600 pages, as did Michael Peach, his editor. And, I mean, even David, there are sections where like it'd be like, you don't need this, you know, and I was sort of a merciless cutter. And I suppose since I had been cutting his work since the beginning, I didn't feel like, oh my God, I can't touch this. I'd be like, this is boring. You're like, I don't understand this. And so, but he was so smart at that point, he knew exactly what he was willing to cut and not. And there are these very funny back and forth letters between him and Michael Peach where he got to the point where it's like, well, if I change this on page 542, then I have to change everything from page 800 on. And we'd be like, oh, okay. And he's in one letter, he says, you know, I had to erase everything from my hard drive because otherwise I'd go back and change it again. He was not against cutting, and he was not actually somebody who, there are certainly writers who are like this, every word I write is perfect. Don't change a single one. Don't change a period. He was never like that. I mean, for someone that smart, he was happy to be edited and happy to be cut. And certainly every magazine editor could cut him, could change things, could edit him and say, we don't need this, or we don't need that, or this is too much, or whatever. As his sister would be the first to say, you know, how much do you want to annoy the reader?
What is the level of reader annoyance?
It's that you're going for here. So yes, I mean, it was cut 400 pages, maybe 500 pages. It's hard to know between the different drafts. And he was, you know, there are certain things where he was like, no, we can't ever possibly cut this. But we didn't feel like, oh, we better not cut a word of this because here's the great man. I mean, unfortunately, the thing is, like, when you kill yourself, then you become the great man and no one wants to change a word.
That's what I was gonna, that you're working on now, and also This Is Water, is that the
This Is Water, well, that was the Kenyan commencement
address. The Kenyan commencement address, which I haven't read yet, but I read that they cut the bit about suicide.
No, this is the weird thing.
They didn't do that?
No.
Okay, phew.
There was this bootleg version that was on the web that someone had recorded the commencement address and put on the web without our permission, without ever asking anything. And there were all sorts of things that had been added. And David had sent me a draft of this because at one point there was an op-ed editor at the New York Times who wanted to try and do it like the following year as a graduation. So I had this. And we weren't going to do anything with it. And I didn't actually sort of do takedown letters on the web or do anything about stuff that appeared out there because it didn't seem to matter. Quite frankly, it didn't seem to matter that much at the time. And Tom Bissell's piece, he sort of had seen the bootleg version, and there are things in the bootleg version which were not David's words. And even Little Brown, when they decided to do this and to do this as a little book, they had a totally wrong version. I'm like, where did you get this? And someone had downloaded it off the web thinking it had been the final version, and it wasn't. And everything is word for word what was in the text. And so that's what it wound up being. I mean, we didn't change, I think there's one comma that was added simply for editing purposes, but it was Michael, myself, and his longtime copy editor who went over this. And I mean, Michael at this point is like, every word should be exactly his word. We're not changing anything. And I'm still like, oh, we could change this. And he was like, no, we're not changing anything. And also, it's like, you know, it's 14 pages long. You can go over word for word. I mean, we can't do that with Infinite Jest, but if this you could say word for word for word. So no, I mean, that was what was weird. And then someone asked for corrections to the TBR, which was not Little Brown and not myself, but someone like wrote in and said, you have this wrong, which is totally bizarre. I mean, that's the thing is like with the internet, there's all this now that's out there, which...
To clarify, did he say it in the speech, but it wasn't in his prepared notes?
We don't know.
Okay.
I actually asked Kenyon, I had done this thing with Kenyon where they were never supposed to release the video because at one point it had been on like YouTube, and then I said, you can't do this. So now I have to go back and say, I know I said this before, but now give it to me. And so they're sending it to me, so I don't have it yet. I don't know if it was in the actual address, but it wasn't in the text that he had prepared. So this is water as a text is exactly what he had sort of said it was going to be. I hope that answers your question. It started in, no, because I was pretty clear with Dan on things. I mean, I think it was like 91.
Because he wrote me, he said it started in 86, 87, 89, but that's what he wrote to me.
I don't know. You know, I mean, there, he was always writing. I mean, Pale King, he'd been writing Pale King for 10 years. And so I just know like when it's sort of like, there's this novel. Do you think we could get an advance on a partial novel? And so I would say it was 91 sometime. But I'd have to go back.
The tennis part of the novel was an earlier. That was the kind of immediate follow-up to Broom and Sistrom as a novel.
About the tennis camp. Yeah, because, I mean, he had been a junior tennis player. And... or sort of on the junior circuit. I guess that's what it is. So I'm sure. I mean, these things were in his head for a long time. But I think the actual starting was probably about 91.
Do we have one more question? Okay.
I had a question to follow up on this. What was the response
at Gourmet Magazine? When Gourmet Magazine he turned in a piece about the lobster festival, raising the question about whether it was moral to even eat lobsters or, in fact, any kind of animals, and how do they tag over at Gourmet?
It was very funny. They sort of thought they were going to get, like, the Illinois State Fair piece of, like, this is so funny, and you make fun of the natives, but you're making fun of your New York Magazine editor at the same time. And so they thought they were going to get that. And there was an editor who's no longer at Gourmet named Jocelyn Zuckerman who had wanted him to do a piece forever and would come up with these ideas. And he was going to Maine with his parents and with his new wife and was like, oh, we can all go to the lobster festival. And of course, when they got an article which is like, is it moral to eat lobster at all? I mean, this is a magazine that has like pages and pages from the beef, you know, industry and pages from the fish industry. They were not going to publish it. I mean, it's that simple. They were not going to publish it.
How did it get published there?
Well, I mean, she...
Ruth Franklin...
Ruth will tell you now, she was a huge defender of it from the very beginning. But we were this close to not having it run. This editor sort of put her job on the line at the time and said, if you don't do this, I will quit. And so they wound up running it. And, of course, got both... like huge amounts of accolades because they were so brave to do it. And also a few people who canceled their subscriptions saying, you know, how dare you do this? I eat my lobster at Newburgh once a week.
That was the thing about the ABN piece, which went so well during the process of editing and then ended up being bowdlerized because the editor-in-chief of Premier just had a kind of a meltdown. And the bowdlerization itself was not greeted with such outrage by many readers, but Dave was very upset about it, and understandably so, but it ended up running with all the profanities hyphenated, which we were asked to do
2 days before shipping. We got quite punchy. I was like, okay, so cocktail, do we hyphenate? Yeah. And I almost quit over that. And Dave actually was very kind and called me up. He said, yeah, I am mad at Premiere. Yeah, I don't like your boss. And yeah, I'm never going to write for the magazine again, but we're still friends and you shouldn't quit on this account because you need, you know, you do good work there and da-da-da. But, you know, and at the time, I don't think I helped the case much because instead of actually putting the argument forward, all I did was act out and be pouty a lot. Like, you fucker, you're ruining this integrity, you know. And if I had actually said to my editor-in-chief at the time, you know, all right, you know, you're really worried about, you know, some Chrysler ad falling out, but you know what? This is what's going to happen. We do this thing, we put it out as is, and, you know, yeah, a couple of people get mad, but you know what? You'll probably get another goddamn ASME nomination. David will be happy to have worked with us again, even if it comes out that he's the writer of the piece, which is going to come out anyway. And, you know, whatever kerfuffle is going to happen, you're still going to come off of it covered in glory. And instead I just sat there and said, you're a douche, you know. And it ran that way, and it was, as in the immortal words of Tone Loc, it was a big old mess. But, yeah, I mean, that's how, you know, you ought to look at it. It's sort of like, okay, well, we may have a little bit of trouble with this here, but, you know, eventually it's going to redound to our benefit. And the other tragedy of that AVN piece was that it was the editing process up to that and doing it was so pleasurable. And it was funny because talking about cutting, he was not averse to cutting. I mean, he was averse to cutting without his consultation, you know, and he was kind of amused. And that's why Kristen von Ogtrop, who had the first stab at David Lynch Keeps His Head, was nicknamed the Blunt Machete. But he was always willing to work with you. And the weird thing about the AVN piece is that we worked on that for a long time, doing all sorts of things, cutting this, cutting that, cutting that. But except for the fact that the profanity was hyphenated, the version that we both agreed on was pretty close to what he originally submitted, and not that much was ended up being cut out of it at all. You know, it was just weird.
Well, I mean, the same thing happened with the one about McCain that Rolling Stone had commissioned, and it was right before Super Tuesday, and McCain, as we all know, fell out then because Bush, you know, the Bush machine sort of went after him, and McCain lost his temper, and what everyone may think of McCain now, McCain then was a rather noble guy, and, you know, Rolling Stone almost pulled it. I mean, Jan Wenner was like, well, let's not run this, it's no longer newsworthy, McCain's out of the race, all this stuff, and they, of course, won a National Magazine Award for it, and Jan Wenner, I think, went up to the podium and was like, I always knew this was a good idea.
Well, you know,
so, I mean, we...
The thing that you can do with an editor is just... And unfortunately, many of you undergraduates will never get the opportunity to do this because there will be no magazines anymore.
But that's your argument when dealing with a case like this. Just dangle that ASME award idea in front of them. They love ASMEs for some weird reason. It's not the design of the damn thing, is it? You know, you've seen those things that suit all of us, but they love them some ASMEs. It's like, you'll get nominated for an ASME. And then they're like...
Well, I wanted to say thank you to everyone. We're a little bit over time. So thank you to all the panelists. For both panel one and panel two. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. And I want to remind everyone that we're going to have readings starting at 8 o'clock tonight with all of our panelists reading selections from David Foster Wallace's work. We have programs that list what those selections will be in a little bit more detail that'll be over here right now, and we'll also be handing them out later in case you didn't already get one. So please come back for later tonight.
Thank you.